can do it. The time is now. Let's get to it. Just believe. Just believe.
In an ever-changing world, Life Changes Network presents the authentically entertaining voice of truth and inspiration. This is Life Changes with Filippo, with the always unforgettable, ever insightful conversations that captivate our fascination and insatiability for the inspiring moments of real life journeys. As we, as one, strive for higher planes of existence and a better understanding of our true selves and the world in which we live, always remembering, life changes. This is radio like you've never felt before. Good for all and all for good. And now your host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Let's get to it, indeed. This is Filippo Voltaggio here on Life Changes with Filippo, and our guest today is an author, a playwright, an actor, and a friend. He is a third-generation filmmaker. Like his father and grandfather, he was drawn to the entertainment business at an early age. In his youth, our guest joined The Stable, a successful repertory theater. His profound performance in the play titled The William won Cleet, our guest, the Dramalog Award for Best Actor. In Los Angeles, that's a big deal, Dramalog Award for Best Actor. He was involved in over 50 plays since then, sharpening his skills as a director, writer, and actor. Our guest focused his sights on writing. He wrote, co-directed, and starred in the feature Dead Silence. He then wrote and starred in both The Fool and Barely Alive, the Lars van Vandermeer story. That year, The Fool was rated one of the top five most watched short films of the Sci-Fi Channel. Cool. Cleet then wrote, starred in, and directed the award-winning feature film Instant Trauma. Cleet's writings and directing of Instant Trauma landed him a seat on the writers panel at the Sedona Film Festival, which includes a bunch of other famous writers from Rainmaker and Scent of a Woman, et cetera, Beverly Hills Cop, et cetera. Cleet has written over 25 screenplays. His screenplay most recently produced was 3 Day Blind. Actually, most recently produced, the very, very most recently produced play is The Different Shades of Hue. And we'll be talking about that play and to our guest, Cleet Keith, right after this.
True performance takes more than just working out. Every day we demand more from our body. But what does your body demand? Hunger is not your body's call for empty calories. It's your body asking for nutrients it's lacking. It's time to reward your body with Boku Superfood, made from the world's finest organic ingredients, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and essential trace nutrients, all developed naturally and organically from nature's most nutrient-dense foods. Boku Superfood is quite possibly the best thing you can feed your body. So listen to your body. Reward it with pure, raw, beautiful food. Boku Superfood.
Clean water is not enough. Reverse osmosis, distilled water, and most bottled waters are devoid of naturally occurring minerals. They are acidic, unstructured, and hard to absorb and rob minerals from the body. IonWay's ionizers produce a super abundant supply of powerful antioxidants in each glass. Ionized water has a reduced molecular cluster size and a negative charge, hydrating you up to 6 times better. Water from an IonWay's ionizer will help you restore your body to its natural pH balance, boosting your vitality. An ionized water more effectively flushes acidic toxins from within your body. Drink the healthiest water available today. IonWay's water systems, their water changes everything. To learn more about IonWay's water systems and how you can own one today, visit our website at lifechangeswithfilippo.com and click on our sponsor page.
Well, Today is going to be an interesting show for many reasons. We have a very interesting guest, and we also have our producer, Mark LeJour, with us. And that's exciting because we don't get to have him all the time, and especially today since Cleet is a friend of our guest, Cleet. Keith is a friend of Mark's, and Mark introduced him to me years ago and talked to me about his play. And then when I finally met Cleet, I got to read his play and become familiar with him and the play, and this play, which imitates life, and life, of course, imitates the play, etc. Like right now, because in the play, the artist, the character, is an artist, and he has two friends that talk with him and in some ways interview him, ask him questions, guide him. And today, Cleet, the writer of that very scene, is going to have two friends, Mark and I, talking to him, interviewing him, and guiding at least this conversation along. And it's interesting because, of course, Cleet himself, our guest, is a writer, an artist, and the play is about an artist, specifically a painter. And interestingly enough, I sat down with somebody just this past week and had coffee with somebody who had wanted to meet me. This person is an artist, a composer, so yet a different artistry. And I had never talked to him before. He had come to know me and my work and wanted to talk to me about perhaps performing in his upcoming opera. And I mention this because as I got to know him during the course of our conversation over coffee, he started to share with me a story I was very familiar with. And it was the story of an artist. And I had heard this story many times before and in some ways had lived it myself as an artist. And I thought, wow, I know this story and I know where it could go, the good and the bad. I've experienced both. And to some extent, there's good in the bad, and there's also bad in the good. It's quite confusing if you don't experience it, actually. But something that I don't know that I've ever done, I correlated his story, the artist's story, to everybody in the world. Having now interviewed so many people and been life coach to many people and friend to many people, and just kind of been conscious of people's stories, that's something I'm most interested in, I realize that so many of us have that same story. It just doesn't look the same or sound the same because it's not about music or it's not about painting. It could be a housewife, or it could be a CEO, or it could be somebody else, but we all have it. We all have a story, and so many of them sound exactly the same, just different words, different mediums, so to speak, as we paint what our life is going to be, or as we write what our life is going to be. I'm wondering if before we bring on our guest, Mark, you probably have something to say to that.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the chance to chime in a little early here, because it was really resonating what you were saying. And as I reflect on our relationship and the way the show has developed over the years, my friendship with Cleet and how that has developed over the years, and the discussion as you were laying it out of good and bad within all of our stories. And you know me, it's something that I talk a lot about in terms of the one thing we all have in common, you know, which is kind of the center point of our show, is that life changes. But that we're here really first and foremost to relate. But what's interesting is we spend so much time trying to avoid the bad because we look at it as bad, that we sometimes miss the good in the bad. Mm. And maybe if we didn't call the bad bad and we looked at everything as good, we would have a better perspective on the entire story. And that's what kept coming through, and certainly as I look back on moments with Keith that become part of my story, and moments with you and our producer Dorothy Donahue and all the people around in my life, you know, there's a lot of good in the bad, and so therefore there's no bad.
And there it is. And actually, somebody else who might have something to say on this subject matter would be award-winning actor, writer, director, our guest, Cleet Keith. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Hello there. How are you guys?
I'm great.
Are you? Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay. I'm greater, but that's a whole different show.
That's always been the case, hasn't it? I'd like to chime in on what you just said, because one of the things that I went through with the play that we're doing is there are a lot of rewrites and changes, and I worked with Sam Anderson, who is a phenomenal actor, and he's been on Lost, he was in Forrest Gump, he's on Justified now, amazing director, and knows his stuff, and part of it were the struggles of taking the play that I'd written and breaking it down to the bare essentials of what was really important within the play. And some of that sometimes is painful. It's like certain things I don't want to cut out, certain things I think are really the mainstay of the play. But once you sit and you collaborate with someone else, you find that maybe that isn't the case. And so Sam and I one time were sitting there out in the audience during a rehearsal, and we just looked at each other, and he said to me, he goes, you know, sometimes it's painful, and it really is a difficult situation you find yourself in your, when breaking down a play like this. He said, but I wouldn't do it if it weren't worth the time. Mm. And sometimes within those times, like you were saying, that the difficult times, the things that we think are really bad, out of it came a play that I'm really proud of. So so that is really the case. I think you're right. Both you and Mark are right.
Mm. You know, actually, I should add about now that we're not, obviously not the only ones that are proud of you. The critics have been raving about this play. And it's so good to read the reviews, because these are people who don't owe you anything, and most of them don't know you, and they're using things like words like the audience gave a rousing round of applause and standing ovation, and people are being really careful not to give away the play. Somebody said if Jackson Pollock and Preston Sturges and John Guari collaborated on a play, it might resemble The Different Shades of Hue in its extremely promising, beautifully appointed premiere. You know, I mean, that's gotta feel good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really overwhelmed by all the response that we've had, and it's been, you know, like you say, it's one thing to hear comments from your friends who are basically always there to support you most of the time. And then to suddenly see it in the papers with people I don't know anybody, and you know, a lot of times theaters will set up people to laugh and do all that stuff so they get great reviews. We didn't do that. We just said, let's see how the play rolls, see what we have to fix, see what we don't have to fix. And the night that we opened, it was pretty overwhelming. I mean, it was a great night, and every night since then has been just really wonderful, and we're very, very proud of it, and not surprised at the response. We had hoped it would be a good response, but just pleased as we can be with the response of the audiences. It's been really wonderful.
And Cleet, one of the things that I think is really special about this particular conversation with you and Mark and I right here on our show is that right now you are that artist experiencing major life changes with a success of, you've had many successes, but a success of yet another child, brain child, heart child, artistic success that in a different realm. To watch the live audience react, et cetera, and to see this all unfold. So when we come back, I'd like to peer into the soul of you as the artist before later on we peer into the soul of Hugh as the artist in the play when we come back here on Life Changes with Filippo.
Are you like many people who want to make positive changes and improvements in your life and in the world around you? Do you ever feel like there's something holding you back from achieving your true potential? Join Stefan and Shaylee Schifeidel with the Tad James Company, the world's largest NLP, coaching, timeline therapy, and hypnotherapy training institute. Get ready for a life-changing experience that will give you the tools to transform your life through positive change and will help you create the future you want now. Their training programs are designed to provide you with the revolutionary knowledge, skills, and techniques necessary to effectively create long-lasting and life-changing effects. Discover more about neuro-linguistic programming and timeline therapy at www.nlpcoaching.com or call 888-440-4823. That's 888-440-4823. You are listening to Life Changes with Filippo on the BBS Radio Network with our host, Filippo Voltaggio. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as David Wilcock, Mariel Hemingway, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Marcy Shymoff, and Shadow Stevens on our archive page at our website at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O.com. Remember, you can also connect with us via Twitter and Facebook, and now in our own community at lifechangesnetwork.com, where real people come together to share real life in real time. That's lifechangesnetwork.com.
So we're talking to Cleet Keith, and we also have Mark Lejour on the phone with us, and we are talking about the play, in a sense. We're talking about the play, The Different Shades of Hue, written by Cleet Keith.
Filippo, before you go into to that next phase, I wanted to chime into something you said before we went to break. As you were talking about Cleet and hearing some of Cleet's comments in terms of being overwhelmed and such, and I wanted a little bit of a backstory for our listeners, because when I met Cleet, it's been 7 or 8 years ago, it was through one of the screenplays that he wrote. And I was involved in a upstart production company at that point, was reviewing a lot of stories, a lot of screenplays, and a lot of potential pictures that had meaning. And yet this was the first screenplay that I was ever moved to tears with. Mm. It is extremely important. I'm not going to mention it because it's sure to get made, and it's going to be a very important picture. But that showed me a glimpse of who this writer was and how special he viewed the world and how much care he put into his writing and the character development, and more importantly, getting the point across and yet doing so in an entertaining way. And as you'll circle back to Hugh and the brilliance that's being reflected back to him, it's so rewarding for me to start seeing what I've seen in him from the beginning, which is a very, very humble brilliance. And I'm really excited to have him on today.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Cleet, how does that feel?
Well, I mean, when I first met Mark, there was just something about our connection, like it was maybe a prior connection somewhere, that we just hit it off immediately. And I had a screenplay that I was set to go to Tom Cruise company, actually that day. I don't know if you remember that, Mark. I was set to go to his company that day to pitch the idea to them. And Mark said to me, you know, is there any way you can not do that so that we can work on this together and try to get something going? And through that, that one day, I just went back and talked to my brother, Chris, who's a producer on almost everything I do, and just said, you know, I think I've met a guy that's going to be a friend for life. There's just something about him. He's just a great, great person. And, and that still stands to today. And, Mark came and saw the play recently and was just so supportive, and boy, that really, it means everything to me, you know?
Wow. This is so nice. Now, one of you two say something nice about me. No, I'm
well,
just kidding.
I'm kidding. You haven't been to the play.
We don't have nearly enough time in this episode.
Oh, okay.
No. But actually, this is exactly where I wanted to go when we came back from the break, is exactly this moment here. Because what Mark is saying about that play, for example, that script, rather, that that he was hoping to and potentially could eventually help turn into a movie and potentially could be a box office hit. That particular screenplay, you already know is good, right, Cleet? It's a trick question, but hopefully...
Yeah, no, I do. It's a cool story, yeah.
Okay, because so many artists, and I wonder if you're where you are with the play, because so many artists will create something, and then it's like you almost said before, where you started to say something about, well, when friends say, but they're supportive, but when a critic says something or when strangers say something, well, that seems to be more meaningful, but does it have to win an award? Does it have to be on Broadway, or does it have to win an Oscar in order for you to know you're a good artist or the play is good?
Well, it's an excellent question, because that does play into what the play basically is about. And, you know, what
I
is...
I know, I read it.
How dare you.
I'm going to come see it, too. I just haven't had time yet.
Okay. You'll get there. But, no, that's what it's about. I mean, I've done a lot of theater. I started when I was 17. I did 17 straight years of theater. And we had Monday nights off and 2 weeks off for Christmas and for the first 10 years. And other than that, I was in the theater. And you learn how to listen to the public, what to take from them. It's a whole different realm getting on the other side where I am now as a writer. Because as a writer watching the play that you've written, it's different than being up on stage and performing in front of an audience, because after you look at it, you look at the play a whole different way. So it's been, in that regard, it's been a whole different life change for me. And to see how people react to specific parts of the play as well that you know are coming up that you want to see, if you're reaching them where you thought you would. And it's great. I mean, I have not had a chance to be on this side. I've done it with film, but not with theater. And boy, am I loving it. It's like coming home, you know?
And you know what I'm also sensing is that you, as you're writing this, I asked you off the air when we were talking earlier today if this was at all autobiographical, and you were saying that it was based on somebody else and somebody else, but when it's coming through you, there's something about you that is in every, I think, in every word, and if not every word, then every phrase. There are elements that, you know, if Sam's saying we need to cut this part out or that part out, it might not just be that you like that part, or it might be resonating in something that you're still working on or have accomplished that you want to celebrate. Do you know what I mean?
No question. You're right on the money with that. And so certain things that are really important to me that I want to get across to an audience may not be his sensibility. Doesn't mean he's right or wrong. It means that we have a different view, just like everybody watching the play. We have a different view of what we think is going to be impactful to an audience. So in that regard, we did see eye to eye in certain things and not so eye to eye in other things, but we were able to work that out. Now, you had mentioned the reason I wrote this play was I sat down with a friend of mine who... This was probably about 5 years ago, and she was telling me about her brother. And her brother, and I won't say his name, but her brother, who she was very close to, used to be an amazing artist that worked on album covers in the 70s for rock and roll bands, and also did tapestries in Westwood that were up above this restaurant called Yesterday's in Westwood. And he was an amazing artist. And then one day started to change, and they noticed the change and went, something is wrong with him. And eventually he became schizophrenic. Now that's a whole different thing. But the point was that once they put him on medication, his life changed. He no longer painted. he was not an artist anymore. He stopped. He zombied out and never picked up a brush again. And she started telling me the story and about what he went through and the things that he did while off the medication. I went, my God, I got to write this. I was going to write it as a film, and then realized that it would probably play better on stage, but I hadn't written a play before, and eventually just said, well, I'm just going to go for it. And I wrote it as a play and gave it to a friend of mine, Craig Berenson, who was a producer on the play. And he took it, and with me, we kind of crafted it more toward the stage. And then he was able to get it to Sam Anderson, to the Road Theater Company on Magnolia out in the valley. And they are the ones who finally put it in a festival in front of an audience, just as a reading, which you were there, Filippo.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience seemed to respond to it, and then he picked it up and said, I want to put it in to our rotation, and then I want to put it into our brand new theater, and then I want to direct it. So it had that life, and that was life-changing as well.
And for those who don't know, a reading would be just a group of actors that play each role sitting on a stage. I think they stood up, right, when they read the part.
They had like music stands in front of them with a script in front of them, so they're not performing per se, but they
right.
are. They've taken a week to go over the script, and they are directed in doing the reading of the play.
And you're right. I was there, and the audience did respond, I mean, very well. And it was great to be in the audience and just feel everybody experiencing it. And like somebody said in one of the critiques, the audience was moved through a roller coaster of emotions. And for this to happen, every facet of the play must be working on all cylinders. So, applause.
Well, yeah, it is. Thank you. And you take a look at it. You take a lot of time to craft something like that, to try to get the audience to where they feel these characters deeply. And that's the main thing for me. It's, you know, you walk away from it, hopefully not walking out of the theater and saying, you know, let's go to you know, Denny's. It's like you want them to walk out of there and have that conversation all the way home, leaving them with something that moves them. And I've had those responses from people that have emailed me and texted me and saying, boy, we talked about one. A friend of mine lives in the San Clemente, and he just said he and his girlfriend talked about it all the way home. And then once I got home, sat in their room and talked about it even more, because it leaves you with some questions at the end of the play, which hopefully good plays do.
And I can vouch for that, Filippo, especially, you know, it points back to something earlier that he was talking about, which is working through the play with new partners, with the theater and the producers who have their own perspectives. And I think the words Cleet used was reducing it to the bare essentials. This play has no bare essentials.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't even imagine the work that he had to go through to get the fluidity and maintain the integrity, keep some of the nuances of the various aspects of information that even I'm aware of that Cleet had to kind of push through and maintain and achieve that result. We did the same, you know, when we left the theater, even though I was familiar with it. We talked it through in great detail and at length, and still refer back to it. And there are aspects of various characters that resonate with everyone. It's beautifully complex and yet simple at the same time.
Thank you,
well,
Marcus.
Yes, thank you. Nancy Bianconi wrote in a critique, Cleet Keith has written an extraordinary play that you won't see every day. Only an experienced and talented playwright could do this. Sam Anderson seamlessly directed a complicated play that will stay in your mind for days. So if you are local to the Los Angeles area, you can go to roadtheater.org, and theater is spelled theatre.org, and road, R-O-A-D, roadtheater.org. And if you're not in the Los Angeles area, you could go to thosekeithbrothers.com. Just like it sounds, thosekeith, K-E-I-T-H, brothers.com, to learn about what those Keith brothers are up to. Of course, we're referring to our guest, Cleet Keith, and to his brother, Chris Keith. And we'll be learning more about what they're up to when we come back right after this.
Listen to these words. He would not be beat by forces too fierce for man, woman, or beast. As the going got tougher, his courage increased. It's a little story with a big message, a message that speaks to children of all ages. It's about believing in yourself, overcoming obstacles, and never giving up. It's been called a masterpiece, one of the finest children's books ever written, and a true children's classic. Shadow Stevens has been called Dr. Seuss for the 21st century. His big little book, The Big Galoot, is a story about bullying. Bullying has become an American epidemic, and The Big Galoot talks about it in a way that will touch the heart of a child of four and a grandfather of 104. It's the story of a little boy with size 42 hands, the biggest hands anyone has ever seen, and the kids laugh at him. Then the laughter turns mean. They mock him and trip him, and much worse. But throughout it all, Warren Galoot says, "I'm a galoot, but I have good luck. You can't get me down. I never give up." A second grader named Chandler said, "I thought it was the best funny book I have seen in my life." And we agree. Whoopi Goldberg said, "This is a great story. Bravo, Shadow." The Big Galoot is available now as an ebook exclusively on Kindle Fire on Amazon for only $3.98. We strongly urge you to get it for your children, your children's children, or as a gift to yourself. Its message speaks to all of us. Have good luck and never give up. Go to Amazon.com and search for The Big Galoot by Shadow Stevens.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening. Someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
You are listening to Life Changes with Filippo on the BBS Radio Network with your host, Filippo Voltaggio. You can visit us online via Twitter and Facebook and at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O.
It is Filippo, and we've got Mark on the line and our guest, Cleet Keith. And earlier, Cleet, we were talking about how with... Mark was saying how he saw you, and you said you saw him and recognized him as someone that you would have a friend for life, and you shared that with your brother, and there seems to be this thread here of mutual respect and understanding that I know I have had with Mark, and Mark with me, and then Mark with you, and then after I got to know you, and you have with your brother, and the two of you being known as the Cleet brother, the Keith brothers. My question is, you know, as artists, we have the voices in our head, so to speak, and then we have the voices that are immediately outside of us. And sometimes those voices are parents that say, "You'll never amount to anything." And then they're the ones that say, you can be whatever you want to be. Can you share a little bit about what you and your brother's relationship has done for you in your process as an artist, since you've done so much together?
Yeah. Chris has been my biggest supporter from day one. It's almost like it's Theo and Vincent. You know, he has always been the one that has helped support me, if literally, financially at times, the supportive word of helping me through, whether it's working on a script or people I have to meet and meetings and all these things. He's always the one I can turn to and say, here's what I'm going to go through. What do you think about it? And I can bounce anything off of him. And he's always been there for me. And it's like a long time ago, I had a reading with Sylvia Brown. Mm. And talked to her and said, she said, "Sir, what do you want to?" It was a 30-minute reading. And I mentioned my brother. And I said, "Well, tell me about Chris." And she said, "You have been with him for hundreds of years and hundreds of lifetimes." And she goes, "And you were in, I think it was Italy, fighting together back, you know, hundreds of years ago. You were always with each other, and you always will be." And that didn't surprise me. You know, it was, I feel that bond with him. He's 2 years and 2 days older than I am. Mm. And we're almost like twins. I mean, we finish sentences together, and we're always thinking of each other and helping each other out in both ways. And whatever I write or work with, as far as my writing goes in the industry, whatever, Chris is always part of that. I always make sure he's involved in some way. So we're extremely close.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Does he feel the same way about you, or does he think you're just a pain in the ass little brother?
Yeah, he doesn't like me at all. Very strange. It's a difficult relationship. It's like with you and Mark. Same thing.
I'm not going to ask which one is which, but okay.
This is a good time for me to chime in, though, and add that I could say all of the same great things about Chris as I did for Cleet. He's very, very special.
Well, we, you know, Chris and I both, having met Mark, if you haven't, obviously, if the people out there have not met Mark before, there's just a special quality about him, a beautiful, heartfelt quality that you just, he makes you feel like you've known him forever, and he's just the coolest, greatest guy. And once we got together, hooked into that, it was like we've always known each other. We'll always be friends, regardless how much time goes in between. We can call each other up and say, "Hey, I miss you. Hope you're okay." And it's, he's just the best, the best.
I can vouch for that too. But you know, if
thanks, Cleet.
If Sylvia Brown were around, we could ask her. For all we know, the two of you have been around each other forever too. So
yeah, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that. There was just, I knew that immediately when I first walked into the room. I think it was at a Coffee Bean or something when we first met. He walked in and went, "That's him. There he is." Knew it.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that you feel that way about Mark. And more importantly, I'm glad to hear that Mark feels that way about you, because I can say that there are a lot of people that wish they could be able to say that about Mark, but because they say, "Oh, you know, I look forward to working with Mark again. And I look forward to doing a project with him or something or other." And I just was in a meeting the other day with somebody said that to me. And I'm like, if Mark, does Mark know how many people want to work with him? Which begs the question, does Mark know how much he's loved out there and appreciated? And doesn't that get back to what I was saying about you? Do you know, as an artist, as a writer, how good you are, no matter if this medium of yours gets an award or not, kind of thing?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. It's a difficult question because you have all the parameters that are set when you're a child. As to, I mean, my dad was an actor, and as a child, watching him being rejected constantly, trying to get jobs as an actor, and seeing that rejection, obviously permeated my being to where I have felt that before, going into meetings and doing projects and coming up with scripts that I think are really viable and can work, and especially after having seen what they put out today, all the remakes and all these things. You look on Rotten Tomatoes and there's like 3%, 17% people like it and all that stuff. I'm going, my God, there are some really good scripts out there, really great stories out there that people aren't, that especially studios don't care. I'm in process right now with another film that I wrote and I'm going to direct with, and we have an actress has come forward and wants to do it. She's great. I love her. She's gonna come see the play, by the way, Mark, I think this weekend. And talking with their agency, the agency is afraid if we wanted to go to the route, let's say, go to Kickstarter and say, you know, let's just do this ourselves. She has 8 million Facebook followers and 4 million Twitter followers. So we're like, you know what, why don't we go on Kickstarter, do this ourselves without having a studio involved or anybody involved. Everybody would want to get to chime in on this, but the agency says we don't want to take the chance that she may fail. Mm. That you may not reach the amount of money that you're hoping for. So that would be a failure on her behalf, and we're not going to allow that.
Mm.
So it's all those parameters that you constantly come up, all the barriers you come up against, and it's how you deal with it, how you react to that. So when I did this play and the reviews came in, I was still sitting home going, okay, now what's going to happen here? Is there something, is the guy going to come out and write another review and say, listen, I was just kidding? you don't, you know what I mean? You always have it in the back of your mind of like, is this really happening when it becomes really good? I hate to say that, but it is, when I see that and it stays the way it is and people keep coming up and enjoying the play, it is life-changing for me, literally. It gives me more respect for myself that I was hoping to achieve eventually, to where I go, you know what, you actually can write and you have some talent. And that's the same thing with the character within the play. And of course I wrote it, so it's there are parts of me within that character of trying to convince myself that I'm worthy of any kind of compliment. So
well,
there you go.
Well, thank you're laughing. You
just so it's on record, please. You are.
Well, you know, he is, and you know, the fact that he said that you actually can write. You know, here was a critic that said, you know, that this is not an easy thing to write. This is not just something that you see every day. And so the fact that you would actually use that word and say, actually can write, well, decidedly, obviously you can, but even more so, you're an artist at it. The interesting thing is that maybe this is something that the three of us can explore together for a moment when we come back, because this is a real question still on my part. There's this fine line. I have friends who are artists and they know they're great at it. As a matter of fact, they know they're so great at it. Something of theirs doesn't stink. And so they're so great that nobody wants to work with them. so there's a fine line. Let's hold that till when we come back. We have the pleasure of having Keith is our guest here today, and the pleasure of having Mark Leger on. I am Filippo Voltaggio. We'll be right back.
Are you achieving your highest potential? Do you know what that looks like? Louise Ashby Life Coaching makes it a mission to bring balance and abundance to every area of your life, giving you the opportunity to do and be all that you've dreamed. Anything is possible if you just believe. Contact author and motivational speaker Louise Ashby for your complimentary session and see if her individualized style is for you. You can email Louise at louiseashby.org. That's L-O-U-I-S-E-A-S-H-B-Y.org. Or telephone 323-592-9302. 3181. That's Louise at louiseashby.org or telephone 323-592-3181. Life Changes with Filippo is a premier radio show presented by Life Changes Network, which is a company whose team has dedicated their lives not only to positive change, but to helping others observe and embrace, honor, and even celebrate their own changes, thus enabling a more positive, inspired life and helping to create a more positive and inspired world. From everyday people to corporate giants, celebrities, and children, we are here to help and to serve. With heart and experience, we bring our message and positive intent into your home or corporate office, and even through appearances on your favorite shows. If you wish to learn more about Life Changes Life Coaching and a private consultation with one of us, corporate event appearances, or if you would like us to appear on your radio or TV shows, visit lifechangeswithfilippo.com and click on our representation page.
David Nichols of the Los Angeles Times wrote, amongst other wonderful accolades, Hugh, referring to our guest Keith's play, The Different Shades of Hugh. Hugh could become a major fantasia about the psychology of creativity. We're going to address that a little more in just a moment. But in the meantime, if you've been listening to our show and want to know more about our guest or more about those Keith brothers, you can go to thosekeithbrothers.com. Thosekeithbrothers.com. Keith as in K-E-I-T-H. And again, if you are local to the Los Angeles area, and this being February and the play going on till March 15th of 2014, you can go to roadtheater.org, theater spelled T-R-E.org, to learn about how you can get, actually, how you can get tickets to the play, to the showings that are still available, because this is unprecedented in this particular theater and in Los Angeles, actually. There are showings that are already sold out. As a matter of fact, the whole weekend of opening weekend was sold out. That, my friend, has got to feel good, too.
And really wonderful, and we do have quite a few nights that have been sold out and some to come. First of all, one of the other things I want to say is I'm so sorry you have to pronounce my name. Okay, I go through that constantly with people going like Cleet. It's absolutely horrible. My dad's name was Cleet, and then he gave it to me and changed his, and I'm still trying to work through that.
You know, it's not horrible. I actually am happy I get to pronounce your name, because it means that I'm talking to you, I know you, and it's a pleasure pronouncing your name. The only problem I actually have when I do pronounce it is that I have a friend named Keith. I grew up with a friend named Keith. And so it's easier for me to go straight to the Keith, and so I don't want to offend you. That's
Keith.
That's
Keith Cleet is his name, right?
Yeah, stop that.
No, thank you, Mark. No, it's okay. I just have had a lifetime of people mispronouncing it and going and feeling horrible about it. And so when I hear it, in fact, I did a play. I was back in, back in Massachusetts, I think, doing a play. And the guy who had to say my name at the beginning, I was doing a play with June Locker. And he went out there and said, starring Clem. And I was like, oh, man, I got to stop this. So anyway, I just wanted to apologize when you go through that and you get off the air and you're very upset with yourself, because why did we have that guy on with that lousy name? I'll understand that.
No, just for the record, I'm not very upset with myself.
Okay. You will be.
I'm actually pretty proud of myself.
Yeah, he got it right more than he usually does.
Hey, Doug is our engineer. Could you mute Mark's mic, please?
There you go. Thank you.
Kidding. So earlier we were talking about I was talking about a really honest question about this fine line that artists walk, that sometimes, I think I heard Barbara Streisand thank her mother from the stage once, saying if her mother hadn't been such a difficult person, I think she used a different word, but hadn't been such a difficult person, she wouldn't have had the desire to prove that she was worth anything. So some people go that way, and some people that grow up with difficult parents go the other way. I don't know if there's a formula, but there are the artists that think they're just great shit. And even if they really are, there is a point where people just don't like working with that for some reason. So there's a fine line. I'm just curious what either one of you actually have to say about that.
Well, Mark, you go into that first.
Well, you know, it's both the some of the things we talked about earlier, that there is a fine line, and I think it comes back to the reality that we're all on stage, right? It's the old adage, the old William Shakespeare, that all the world is a stage, and you know, we're all improvising, we're all acting, and we're all learning as we go. And we're doing so based on the programming from those who came before us and those that were around us. And it's either mom and dad, or it's dad and the nanny, or mom and the nanny, or big brother and sister, or whomever. But it's those people that had the most influence become our, you know, basic programming or the basis of our worldview. And so not only is it a fine line, but I think it becomes core to everything that we are and everything that we become, and that becoming ultimately forces us to look back and reconcile those influences and the color and the, you know, the multidimensionality of every character that has influenced us as we grow.
Absolutely. And you know, when you listen to Bruce Lipton talk about psychology of our being, and is it Joe Dispenza? Is that the name, Mark?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's saying that, you know, we work with on a conscious basis, 5% is what we work on a daily basis, and 95% of our subconscious is really what's running our day. So those things that were programmed into you as a child are really what you're driving your each day with that program. And so sometimes, even though you're not even, most of the time, probably you're not even aware of it, but those things that were put into you from your parents or what have you, run your day, and how you react to certain things, whether it's somebody who is not into one of your projects, or somebody who disagrees with your writing or what have you, you react accordingly to what program was put into you when you were a child. So that's really difficult to overcome sometimes. But the main thing is, if you're aware of it, there are things you can do and try to turn that around.
I love the fact that you know and can quote these people who are out there sharing the new science and the new concepts. And what I love about this is that this can and does, I know, get into your art, and then through art, through quote unquote entertainment, people are educated. And in
I'm sorry to cut you off, Filippo. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm done now.
Oh, well.
Enlightened was going to be my last word. I mean, what one could one say after enlightenment?
Wow, I guess I just ruined the whole damn night, didn't I?
I wouldn't use that word.
Yeah, he never uses night. But that's
darn,
you know,
night.
In where Filippo was taking that, you know, I want to speak to it a bit, because you really bring this into your screenplays, you bring it into all aspects of your craft, if you will, and certainly this play. And I've, you know, talked over, and you've shared a couple other concepts that are coming down the pipe that are equally, if not even more brilliant, and will affect society deeply. And I think we're what's so beautiful about this is these conversations that happen after Hugh are happening for a reason, and that's because people are waking up. They're paying attention. They're listening. We have a whole young generation that grew up on the internet and is not subject to mainstream programming, the likes that we were when we only had 5 channels or 10 channels or 12 channels, and watch the same thing over and over and over. And when you listen to Bruce Lipton, you understand how your thoughts affect your cells. And we listen to Dr. Joe Dispenza and countless other both New Age and Aboriginal sciences and writings and teachings.
Old age.
And yeah, you look at you look at all of these influences. You start to recognize that this awakening is your content is not just there to entertain. It's really filling a need. It's filling a void. It's filling a deep need for introspection, for conversations like we're having today. We're exploring things. People are starting to actually pay attention to, why did I do that? Or why do I feel this way? Or how can I do it better? Or maybe we shouldn't do things the way that we did them before. Maybe tradition isn't that great if it brings us back in this circle and continues to tear people down, or continues to avoid a poverty, or look the other way to homelessness, or whatever the case may be, right? And those are all deep subjects and greater systemic, you know, discussions. But I think even in its simplicity, just the nuance that you project out there with such a beautiful story of you causes people to think and look at their own creativity, their own life, and how they're relating both to themselves and how they're spending their days, their own passions, their own bliss, but how they relate to the people around them.
Well, that's the best theater you can have if you can do that. And part of what I'm trying to do is what you said at the beginning of this whole conversation, Mark, at the beginning of the program, was if you can drop in this certain information that hopefully will make people more introspective with themselves, but do it in a way that's entertaining or humorous, then for me, I've won.
Indeed. And I would, for one, would say that you've won and are going to win many, many more times. And I think all of the colorful story that is your backstory, and we haven't even gotten into a fraction of your third generation upbringing and the people who have had influences on you, like Don Knotts and so many greats. And it's so clear when you spend any time with you that there's so much color and ability to laugh at some tough subjects, ability to peer through the looking glass of the complexities of the human mind and soul, and find the funny and disarm with that funny, and then shine a light on you know, an alternate perspective. And I am here to tell you that I know that there'll be multiple people that walk away from that enlightened as to their own challenges and or their own struggles with how others may have perceived them and what they were projected on in terms of what was right or not right, or you know, how their approach could have been different, or you know, I don't want to go into specifics because I certainly don't want to give away some of the beauty of the twists and turns that is a story. But you've certainly landed that. You know, I would urge all of our listeners to, you know, shut off network television and get in a car and drive to the Road Theater and take this play in, and you'll really enjoy it.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, actually, there was a critic that said, I don't want to give it away because you're going to see it because you have to. So we love him or her who said that, because she gets it. You know, actually, This has been and continues to be really beautiful, and we have an interesting opportunity. This has not happened, but evidently the show that comes on after ours is doesn't have an airing tonight for some reason, and so the engineer for PBS Radio has extended that a little bit of extra time to us to continue our conversation. And interestingly enough, Mark and I have often said as has our producer Dorothy, that some of the greatest conversations happen before and after the show, because we sort of let go and the cameras seem to be off or the microphones or what have you, and sometimes something else happens. So it is now 8 o'clock and the show is officially over and it's been wonderful. However, we can pretend that the cameras and the lights and the microphone is off and continue on for a few more minutes and have a little taste of what might happen after. Shall we?
We shall.
Okay. Well, let me start with this, actually. Mark, I'm so glad you repeated Don Knotts, because this time I heard it. When we were talking or texting earlier, and I actually texted you the words, Cleet is very funny guy, and we know that, but it's fun to reaffirm. And I said beautiful and smart, by the way. But you wrote back, he learned funny from Don Knotts. Now, that was a text. What I read was he learned funny from Don Rickles. And you went on to say, and it shows from his personality. And for the life of me, I could not make the connection between Cleet's personality and humor and Don Rickles. I just couldn't.
Didn't Don Rickles learn from Don Knotts?
I don't think so. Just don't think so. who would you associate more with, Mr. Keith?
Yes, obviously Don Knotts. So Don, I worked on a play with him, and a really cool story about him. I got to know him pretty well through traveling with him, There was a part in the play that he was doing, because he was such the funny guy and on Andy Griffith's show and all that stuff, that he was such a sweet, beautiful person, but he had a lack of confidence in the fact that he felt he could not be a leading man. Mm-hmm. And in this play, he was playing the leading man. Mm-hmm. And what was asked of him was to, at this one point in the play, to go downstage toward the audience and stand there and talk to the audience, you know, within the character, not literally to them, but in the play, about how he lost this woman. He was in love with this woman, and he started to cry when he was in her arms. Mm. And I was there during rehearsal, and he just said, I can't do it. And the director, who is now my brother-in-law, Jonathan Daly, said, "Well, it's, you know, we'll have you downstage. Don't you just trust that?" And he could not trust it. And so we had to put him back upstage and turn him kind of at an angle so he wasn't facing the audience and being so vulnerable and exposed. And boy, did I learn from that, you know, you can be the greatest star in the world and everything, but it doesn't mean you don't have those insecurities that lie deep beneath the skin. And he, because he felt everybody's going to laugh at him. That was his main thing. If I go down there and I start talking about something that's emotional, the audience is going to laugh at me. And Jonathan was saying, no, they won't. If they're into the play, and they will be, they won't. And he still couldn't do it. So he was a great guy, really, really, really great, sweet, kind person.
Wow, that's really powerful, and I would submit that is the case with the majority of actors. Interestingly enough, Mark and I were talking about something like that today, how sometimes actors become actors or singers become singers because people think they're weird or they can't relate to people, so they bury themselves in a craft. And then the irony of ironies happen is because they either get so good at that craft or they get so weird at it that you just can't help but look at it. Now all of a sudden you've got all the attention of all the people you didn't want attention from, or maybe you did want attention, but now you don't know what to do with it because you haven't been given the tools to deal with it. And so it becomes this conundrum that so many actors, not all stories are like that, certainly, but there are a lot of stories like that in Hollywood.
Well, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you see something like Philip Seymour Hoffman, the tragedy that happened with him, and you wonder, you know, seemed like a very kind of shy guy and kept to himself. And sometimes being in the public eye like that does turn you inward to where you can't deal with things anymore, or you don't want to deal with all the attention anymore and the problems that result from being in this business. It gets really stressful and difficult, and you turn to whatever you feel you can deal with. And unfortunately, he couldn't, you know, it's just so he was an amazingly talented guy, and to lose his life that way, to me, was so tragic. Oh, it just tore me up. And he was only 46.
Very tragic.
Yeah,
very,
man.
Tragic.
Horrible.
I've never shared this on the air. Actually, I've only shared it with a few people. But since, obviously, we're not on camera or on mic, I feel compelled. It's very apropos. But I had a lady who I did not know, but a friend of mine said she was the astrologer to the stars and had done all the stars and all that stuff. So when I first came out to Hollywood, I went to her and she did my chart. And she said that she couldn't wait to meet me because according to my chart, I was supposed to be dead. And now that I'm sharing this, I know it's a bigger story than I've just opened up a whole can of worms. But what she said was that I had everything that the stars can have, you know, in order to be a child star. And then I would have, I wouldn't have been able to handle it. And I would have killed myself, drugs, sex, alcohol, whatever it was, I would have killed myself. And as I look at my past personality and traits and behaviors, I would have. I'm quite sure I would have, because I wouldn't have been able to handle it. So it's interesting that she says there was one thing and one person and that stopped you from being a star. And it was my father, interestingly enough. And because she said he was born around this time, et cetera, and that's my father. But the person who I thought was the bad guy in my life all my life was maybe the person that saved my life. But I mentioned this because she said, you're going to learn something. And once you learn it, then you can be a star. You can be whatever you want. It's not going to, you're not going to kill yourself from it, because you're going to know. And I feel like I know certain things right now. I have certainly learned a lot, grown a lot. And interestingly enough, I kind of feel like I want to have a class for actors or singers or whomever on how to be famous, how to deal with it, how to handle it. Because I feel like I know that, even though I'm not at that level, I think I kind of get what we're talking about.
Wow.
Well,
I mean, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, well, Filippo, I think what you're saying is obviously so very important. And I want to add one more facet to that, because there is also there's a whole other approach that so many take, which is the kind of the David Bowie approach. You know, the falling so deeply not only into their craft but into a character to then pull off their craft. And so then they're forced to deal with the fame from an inanimate place or an inauthentic place, and even further distant from the masses, the inquiries, the microscope, you know, the spotlight, etc. And then having to live in an authentic way, and I think that's also the difference of what's going on these days. Is, you know, back when there was it was a little bit easier to become someone and then have it managed by the press and or shielded. You know, it wasn't the age of real time streaming and cameras everywhere and you know, everything's instantly virally shared you know, on the internet, and you know, the judge and jury is in the public as opposed to the court largely often. And so there's all these different aspects, which maybe were there to a certain extent But I think have changed so rapidly. And then when you add this other layer of oftentimes inauthentic participation, this is now points back to what I've seen you become. And as I've seen you grow in the, you know, almost four years that we've been on the air, is an ability to just be you. And I think this is what entertainment is becoming. It's becoming authentic. You know, there's a reason why Dean Martin and Carol Burnett and those shows were so powerful. And it was because they left in the mistakes. They laughed. They had fun. There was a realness to them before things got overproduced and so canned that reality became, unreal. And I think this is part of, I'm kind of anchoring it and highlighting it because this is who we are and who we aspire to be and continue to step into in a greater way is an authenticity and a willingness to have these discussions, to have fun, to, rib each other a little bit, but just to enjoy life in an authentic way. And I think there's a peace when you're dealing with anything in your life, when you're dealing with it from a true and authentic place. And that's where the strength comes from. If you're hiding something about yourself and you're living in that untruth and or just shielding even an aspect of your personality from the greater public, that in itself is a struggle and a challenge. And I think that's why so many of these stars fall, because they're having to face every day holding themselves up to a standard that's been granted to them or that's been projected upon them that may not be possible to maintain.
Yeah, especially with their type of personality, because everybody's different, right? It's like you look at the Justin Bieber thing and all that. Where, I mean, there are kids now who are, 12 or 13 are suddenly superstars, and nobody says no to them. And suddenly, I saw him in, because I work in an office in Beverly Hills, and I saw him driving down the street in this silver, it was literally like a reflective silver, I don't know what it was, like a Mercedes or whatever, and he looked like a little kid, a little teeny kid behind the wheel. I'm going, who is that guy? I go, oh, it's Justin Bieber, slamming down the streets, and because there nobody's saying, stop, this is crazy, you're out of control, and the amount of money that they make, it becomes so distorted. Their life is so distorted, and nobody's willing to step forward and say, stop it, get a grip, you're a child, pull it together. And Mark, what you said about the huge difference now, because my dad was an actor back with Orson Welles and all that stuff, and back then it was all managed. And your publicity person protected you and hid you, and there was always that barrier between you and the public to make sure that filter, to make sure that everything was good for the actor. Today, with a camera in every phone, with a camera in every phone that you have, it's like nobody's protected. And if you say, well, if I don't do anything wrong, what's the problem with that? If you've ever had that before where there's a camera stuck in your face every time you walk out of a door or a building, right. I've seen it so many times, we all have, it can eventually do you in if you don't have the proper personality for it.
Right. Well, and not only are they not saying no, but worse, so many are saying yes because it's profit-driven. And if I can keep him happy, I'm going to get, a piece of that revenue, and I'm going to get a piece. I'm going to get a ride in that car. I'm going to get a car like that, whatever the case may be. There's the driver becomes profit. And so many people, start to rationalize. And so the integrity of when to say yes and no completely goes out of the window because there's so much reward on profit. And then there'll be somebody else that comes down the street, right behind them. And, they move on to the next one.
Yeah. And in the rock world as well, I'm reading a book now called Wild Tales by Graham Nash, which is a fantastic book. And talking about back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, as Crosby, Stills, and Nash were moving on, and the amount of drugs that were taken by these guys. And he says it without problem in the book. He tells all the truth. And you hear about There was no saying no to these guys. If they, whatever drugs they wanted, whatever women they wanted, whatever they wanted, it was always, you got it, whatever you want. And that, he said, became just an addiction as well, that we could do whatever we wanted to do. And it's not a good thing.
You know, Cleet, you actually in real life played a character, and that character was the real life character of John Lennon, right? In a film that you actually, right? So what was that like, stepping into those shoes of somebody that famous, that much of a legend, and playing that?
Well, I mean, that was one of the joys of my life, because I, you know, ever since I was a kid, I was a huge Beatle fan, and I used to do his voice all the time. I still do it. I can't get it out of my head. And to be able to step in to do that for, it was a film called Instant Trauma that my brother and I put together, and it did very well in the festivals, and I was able to literally step into being him, even though part of the joy of it was I always wanted to be like him and to play him somehow, but I didn't look like him per se, but I came up with a way to play him without having to look like him. But it's a very funny premise, but and able to step into that, to me as an actor, I really love putting on the costume and feeling that person. And with John Lennon, it was, boy, man, I was in my element, because I was able, you know, I was able to be just like him whenever I wanted to, you know.
And on top of that, Filippo, even another aspect of Cleet's brilliance is he went back and reverse engineered a lot of the chord structures that John and the Beatles used, and worked through with one of his composing partners, and created some original music that is certainly Beatles and John Lennon-esque.
Oh, wow.
That was fun. It was great fun, man. I love it. Great fun.
Now, of course, you only played him for a couple of days or weeks or what have you to do the film, and I know that, you know, in one of the scenes you're in a limousine or whatever, and of course it's not like having, you know, the whole world watching you at that moment, so it was different. But did you gain any insight on what it might be like to be, well, to be John Lennon, probably more importantly, but to be that kind of famous?
Well, I'll give you another example that was overwhelming for me. I did a play a long time ago, and the play was called Hail the Nebraska Dreamer, and it was about a guy that was very famous, and then eventually, as he got ill, and then went back to find all the people that he wronged in his life and tried to make that right. So what we had to do was, for these projection of slides back on the back of the set, was to get these, show the appearance to the audience that I was a famous person at one point. So I had some friends that worked up at Universal Studios, and they said, why don't we just bring you up there and we'll have you, you know, on one of the tour stops with the what do you call them? The tour. I don't know what they call them. The little buses that bring you through.
Yeah, the tram goes around the Universal Studios. Yeah,
the tram. And we'll put you to stop, and maybe we can get some photos. So I said, great. So I dressed as the character, and as these trams pulled up, my friend who works at Universal said, "Ladies, now these are people from Iowa and, you know, the Midwest, and they're excited to be there." They said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're very lucky to have a star has decided to come out and say hello to you, who's going to be on a brand new series. His name is, you know, probably said Cliff, but, you know, Cleet Keith." And they got off the tram and they ran at me. And it was hundreds of people. And all my brother wanted was to get a couple of photos that we could use. Well, he was shoved out of the way, and it was so horrifying. Some guy shoved his baby at me.
Wow.
And to take a shot with me and the child. And it got so out of control that I looked at Chris like, get me out of here. you've got to get me out of here now, because people were pushing and grabbing and shoving each other to get close to somebody they felt was something. It was so bizarre, and they grabbed me and pulled me through the crowd and got me out of there, people screaming and yelling. I've never felt anything like that. I'm sure that's what the Beatles went through, and, you know, maybe Justin Bieber and all these guys that go through
yeah.
that. It was really kind of horrifying. I hated it. But boy, I felt what it was like, and it was really just alarming.
You know, that's a great story and perfect for what I was asking. And it reminds me that it reminds me to remember that I so don't want to judge or second guess as much as is possible for me as a human. And want to encourage people to not judge. I tell on myself in this similar way when I say that when I was just getting started in the music business, it cost a lot of money back then to put together not only a CD, to not only to make the CD, but then to have headshots taken, and then to mm-hmm. print the headshots on glossy paper, and they had to be exactly a certain way and a certain size, and then to go to the print shop and actually print out resumes, and if you got it wrong, uh-huh. you'd have to get a new printer thing set. I mean, the process was incredible, and so it cost you at least, I don't know, $20 to $30, if not $40 per package to send to music producers and record companies and all of that. And so I spent hundreds of dollars, if thousands, well, a lot more than that in different ways, but just on packages alone. And I would not get a call back. And I promised to the world and to myself, no matter how big I got, or how famous I got, or how busy I got, if somebody takes the time to write me or call me, I will respond. Well, that's ignorance. I mean, I like that I felt that way, and I still feel that way. And I can't wait to have people that work with me and for me that can do that, because today I have literally thousands of emails and several dozen phone calls and a few that I've not responded to, and God only knows when I will.
Right,
and I'm
right.
not, and I'm not the president of RCA at the time. You know? So what do I know from where
yeah.
I am?
Well, you know, in the book Wild Tales, Graham Nash talks about he and his buddy Alan Clark, who were both in their band at that time and became the Hollies. They
yeah.
cut school and went to see the Everly Brothers play at the local in Manchester. And once it was over, they knew the only place they would probably be staying was at this one hotel. So the Hilton or whatever in Manchester. So they ended up sneaking over there and going over there, and they went up and tried to act very adult and said, so what are Phil and was it Phil and Don Everly? I can't remember. I think it was Phil and Don. When are they going to be here tonight? And then the guard said, oh, they'll be here soon. And they went, oh, they're going to be here. So they waited and waited till like 11 o'clock at night. The guys, the Everly Brothers had gone out and had some drinks. They stroll back in the snow at night. They get to the hotel, and there's Graham Nash and Alan Clark waiting to talk to him. They're 17. And they go up to Phil and say, you know, we saw your show. And he said they stopped, and they took the time. He said it felt like an hour. He said it was probably only a couple minutes. But Phil said, Graham, don't ever stop. Keep playing, and hopefully it works out for you. And he said he was so gracious to me and gave me he said, we had a 9-mile walk home, and we were so excited, and because he gave him the positive response that made him want to continue and be in rock and roll. And he said, from that, he has never, ever forgotten that. And whenever he's on tour or anywhere at a market, If somebody comes up to him, he stops everything, turns, and chats with them, and will not turn. If he's on a bus getting ready to pull away, he'll stop the driver and say, "What's going on with you?" and talk to the person who is waving at him and everything, because it made such an impression on him.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too.
I love that. And I wonder, as much as I love that, I wonder if you make him Justin Bieber, like you were talking about, where in these day and age, it's easy for people to text you and Instagram you and tweet you and Facebook you. And if he would be able to.
That's a good point. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that everybody today is kind of either leery about what people want from them now, or what are they after, or are so insulated that they don't care. Whereas back then, you know, you were accessible, and you could go up to those guys and say hello and have your life changed by whatever they told you. So I don't know. That's a good point. I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Well, yeah, it also reminds me that I don't remember if it was a guru or somebody from India, I think, who once said that fame was not natural. And I loved it. He said something to the effect of, dogs do not all hover around this one particular dog because they saw the dog on TV. And when you put it in that perspective, it doesn't make sense, fame.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes me think of some of the points that we've touched on, like even the Everly Brothers making such an impression on these, at the time, young and probably struggling artists. But I just lost my point.
I don't think the fame has ever truly served the individual. And maybe that's why they always refer to the 15 minutes of fame, because I think that fame, you know, became used in such a way as marketers got smarter and smarter, as we learned psychology more and more. And of course, even looking back at history and what notoriety did when before it was necessarily recognized as fame, maybe still, you know, similar in various cultures. But I don't think it's ever really served the individual yet for a small for a short amount of time. It's always been leveraged by a higher agenda and driven by a higher agenda most often. Certainly there's many special cases when you look at the Nelson Mandelas of the world, but look at what they had to go through to get that kind of fame. And then where, you know, where did they go with that? And, you know, how is it used by the greater populace? And, you know, what's the positive side of fame when it wasn't just for the individual, when it was really truly in service? And I think there's the key, there's a difference. There's someone loving their craft, enjoying their craft and blooming as an individual and becoming famous for it. There's an integrity there, and there's many that have had lasting careers because of their ability to really cultivate that passion. But then there's others that have really been brought up maybe and championed by the system. And I think that's the big disconnect. And hopefully we're moving away from that more to the core essence of really supporting people in their pursuit of their craft and their pursuit of spending more and more of their waking hours in that and doing that which they love, as opposed to being employed by the system or for a higher agenda.
Beautiful. And thank you, Mark. That reminded me, and it fits right into the point that I was going to make, but even better now, that there's an email that circulates every once in a while, and it says something to the effect of that there's a very small percentage of the children in elementary school know who Elvis Presley was, and a smaller percentage Frank Sinatra, and so you just go on to these people who, you know, and John Lennon, a very small percentage of the children know, and they may never know as they grow up. And to the same token, the email then goes to ask questions like, who won the gold medal in 19 whatever, and who won the best film, or who was the best actor in 19 whatever. And invariably, especially now with so much information in our heads and so many things to think about, we don't remember. But here is the point that Mark was just saying, and what a perfect illustration, I think. Then the email says, who taught you how to ride a bike? Who was the first person you were able to tell a secret to? Who was your best friend? And questions like these, where they get to the heart, your heart, and they're people that you connected with and had an experience with that was positive and touched you personally, you'll never forget those people. And so,
yeah, I love that. That's great. That's beautiful.
I could see that in a play, actually. Can't you, Cleet?
Well, I mean, you know, honestly, what we were just talking about is kind of the crux of the play as well, is what an artist goes through and what people expect from you and what you expect from yourself and how the public feels that they can almost run your life for you because they feel that they know you now. And it's not that way, because you're an individual, especially an artist, who has put out, you know, all the energy and has, of course, the gift and is doing his work. But in the long run, it seems like sometimes it filters into what the public perceives of you and expects of you. And that suddenly becomes part of your persona, and you have to try to figure out what is really best for me and what is best for the public. But in ferreting out those things, it really gets down to your own heart and what is really best for you. And sometimes that becomes maybe like a Philip Seymour Hoffman situation, where you just can't figure it out and you're so lost that you deal with it in different ways.
You know, thank you, Cleet, for bringing us back to that, because interestingly enough, one of the underlying questions in my mind that I've had since first reading the play and then seeing the reading, and that I can't wait to explore once again when I see the live performance, is what is who's right? From all everybody has a perspective, and yet there is this person who has a feeling, the artist Hugh has a feeling of what his life is or should be or could be or where he is or whatever it is. I don't want to say too much, and so I'm stumbling over my words, and that's why I have not asked the question. But I'm going to ask the question, and I don't want an answer, because I think after people see it, and I have a feeling that they'll be able to see it in New York or their town someday, and that's my wish and hope for them and the play and for you, Cleet, that even if I can't, how do I ask this? You know,
I know, you gotta be careful.
Yeah, I'm trying to be really careful. So, I mean, what is the worth of life? Like, is it fame that he needed or needs or should have had or has or would have had or because, you know what I'm saying? It's like, in the end, who is the person that can determine what was quote unquote right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Does the public have the right to push their judgment upon a specific, let's say an artist, into doing what they feel he should do? And in that regard, does the artist follow that or not? And that's kind of the crux of the play. We're going around it a little bit because we're trying to give many things. But it's like, do we have a right to tell an artist how he should live his life? As you know, a society, and in doing that, what are the ramifications that take place with that artist?
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's an interesting question. That's why I just wanted to explore that.
I'm so glad we came to that, and I'm glad you did. And certainly it would make such great, it will make great conversation for anybody who sees the play, that and so many other things that one can talk about afterwards. And it is a difficult play to review, as one of the critics said, because you just want people to have their experience with it and not taint it or you know, bring light to, you know, allow them to go through the process. And that's just it. And that's a brilliant writer that can take people through that. And like Mark also said it towards the beginning of the show, I too, when I read the script, felt very connected to it. And I was sitting on a plane crying, thank you very much, Cleet, thinking, okay, what are people thinking I'm reading here? Like a dear John letter or what? Dear Filippo, you're on the plane right now and I'm breaking up with you. But so if you are local to Los Angeles, I'll say one more time, go to Rode Theater, RODTHEATRE.org, and you can find out where you can see the play. And otherwise, go to those Keith brothers to find out about what else is going on in these two very special people's lives, those Keith, K-E-I-T-H, brothers.com. And speaking of very special, Mark, it's been very special having you on and the dialogue that we've been having. And Cleet, always a pleasure. I'm looking forward to seeing you soon, actually, at your play.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. And Mark, you know, I love you. You're like a brother to me. And Filippo, I am looking forward to seeing you at the show. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Well, this has been great. I'm glad we actually had the extended time, because who better to do it with than a friend and somebody that we can explore and play like this. And what a wonderful thing it was.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
So, all right. Have a good night. Ciao, everybody. I'm Filippo Voltaggio reminding you, as life changes, we're here for you. Good night.
You have been listening to Life Changes with Filippo, with the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the BBS Radio Network, and visit us online at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O. Today's show has been made possible in part by our sponsors, IonWays Water Systems, Change Your Water, Change Your Life, and Love and Miracles with Dorothy Lee Donahue. To learn more about them, visit the sponsor page of our website. Once again, join us here next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. Change the world.